Victor the Voice Furman.
I'm the Romance Reverend Lori Sue Brockway.
Welcome to Love and Romance Radio on the DTM Wicked Radio Network. I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
I'm the Romance Reverend Lori Sue Brockway.
Welcome to Love and Romance Radio on the DTM Wicked Radio Network. And welcome to Love and Romance Radio. I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm the Romance Reverend Lori Sue Brockway.
And you know, Lori Sue, when we think of romance and fictional women journalists, a couple of names come to mind. For example, Hildy Johnson from His Gal Friday, Lois Lane, of course, from Superman, and Brenda Starr, who was a star of her own right. But tonight's guest adds a new character to the mix named Skylar Shaw. Our guest tonight is Tamara Lush, and she knows firsthand about women in journalism and romance. Tamara is an award-winning journalist with the Associated Press. She first started writing in grade school, penning elaborate stories inspired by Raiders of the Lost Ark. After completing her undergraduate degree at Emerson College in Boston, she began her reporting career at a small weekly newspaper in Massachusetts. Her work has appeared in The Village Voice, People Magazine, the St. Petersburg Times, the Boston Globe, and USA Today, among others. When Tamara isn't writing or reading, she's doing yoga, cooking for her Italian hubby, or chasing her dogs on a beach on Florida's Gulf Coast. And her character, Skylar Shaw, is featured in her compelling first book, Hot Shade. Please join us in welcoming Tamara Lush. Good evening, Tamara.
Welcome.
Yay. Thank you for having me. This is really exciting.
Well, I am so excited to have you on the show because I really never, hardly ever meet real journalists who are real romance writers. You know, usually people have a story about, not all the time, but I know there's a lot out there, but I was just so excited to see you working your day job, pounding your beat, and also getting into the romance field. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, when was that moment that you knew you had to be a writer?
Oh, it was a long time ago. It really was when I was in grade school. As Victor said in your intro about me, I really was influenced by Raiders of the Lost Ark. I loved that story, and I loved the idea of this sort of adventurous, swashbuckling man who traveled the globe and did really interesting and creative, crazy things, and an adventurer, and his the female love interest. I was really captured by that. So I would write these little stories and, you know, elaborately, you know, draw a picture on my cover. And they always had to do with like mummies and archaeologists and explorers. And there was always some foreign guy who was the hero, and there was always a heroine, and she was always sort of sassy and strong. And so I'm really not writing anything different now, actually, in my fiction, mm-hmm. I don't think. So I've always thought about those stories. And then when I got into high school, I really liked, you know, the sexy romance stories. I loved, you know, V.C. Andrews. I loved Erica Jong. I loved sort of the spicier stories back mm-hmm. then, too. So I've always liked them.
And from there, how did you find your way into journalism?
Oddly, that also happened in high school. I went to a small school in Vermont, and we had it was not called a debate team. It was called a forensics team, which is not, you know, a club about, you know, dead bodies. But it was about, it's a debate team. It's a public speaking team. And my category was radio, and I would actually have to, examples of AP copy that was, you know, ripped off of the old AP wire. Mm. And I would actually have to retime and read a newscast. And I won lots of awards doing that. I loved reading the news. And so I ended up going to Emerson College. And I actually majored in broadcast journalism. And my first job was in radio at a small radio station in Massachusetts. And my voice was a little higher back then. So I wasn't able to get a job in Boston, but I did get a job at a local newspaper. So everything just kind of flowed from there. But my, you know, my first love in journalism was always radio, actually.
I know well the term rip and read because I started actually in Armed Forces Radio and TV. I was a broadcaster in Korea and Japan and Guam. And in those days, we had our teletype. And every time you heard the five bells, you knew something earth-shattering was happening. You had five bells on the teletype machine. That meant a major story was coming through.
Yes. And I mean, lots of young journalists have no – I mean, I'm 45, and lots of young journalists have no idea what that even means now. You know,
absolutely.
Or to see in almost every AP office – we don't have one in Tampa, but not in many AP offices – there's always, like, an old teletype machine there. Sometimes it's in, like, a little glass case. And there's one in the New York office, and it's like this touchstone of history of the AP, because the AP is such a storied history, you know, going back to the Civil War, but the teletype machine, and a lot of people don't remember that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And today they have Twitter.
Today they have Twitter, and we have a lot of people following us on Twitter on AP. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, I wrote my first story on a Selectric. It was a long time ago. People don't remember when you actually had to bring the copy into the newspaper or to an editor. You're working for a huge major news organization. I'm wondering, do you have a particular beat? You must have seen a lot of tragedies and covered a lot of really difficult stories in your day.
Yeah, I've been with the AP 7.5 years, and in that time I've covered the Haiti earthquake, I covered the Gulf oil spill, I was part of a team that won a Polk Award for an investigation of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. I covered a lot of varied things. Right now, I'm what's called the Tampa Bay correspondent, so I'm based in St. Petersburg, and I cover the west coast of Florida. Which means I cover a lot of, you know, the big breaking news, unusual stories, of which there are many in Florida. But I'm also pulled into national stories a lot. For instance, last week I helped out from here on the San Bernardino story. I was part of a team that called the victims' families and the victims' friends from San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. I also did that with Charleston. And for instance, today I have a story out about Muslims in communities. And I'm called to sort of help and anchor stories, national stories that, you know, span lots of time zones and lots of different reporters. And I'm called to sort of put them together and write them.
Wow, that's a huge job.
Well, obviously speaking to the victims is very difficult, but let's get it out up front. What's the most difficult or a couple of the most difficult stories you've ever had to cover?
Oh, well, yeah, the recent mass shootings have been very difficult. But I would say, hands down, the most difficult story I had to do on so many levels was the Haiti earthquake. I flew in there. We chartered a Learjet to get some of us in there, and we landed it was a little less than 48 hours after the earthquake hit. We actually had, the AP had the only full-time correspondent, Western, you know, North American, non-Caribbean reporter living there. So we had somebody there on the ground, and we were able to get others there quickly. I was there fairly quickly, but that, the 10 days I spent there after the earthquake, and then I went back later that year for 3 weeks, those were difficult days, both physically and emotionally in reporting. And I was changed dramatically after covering that event.
Well, I mean, when you got there, there wasn't even a place to stay, right? Did you have to sleep in tents or something with the locals and backyards? And
well, there was a hotel that was half demolished, the Villa Creole, and we had rooms there. We mostly did not sleep in them. We mostly kept our stuff there and we showered in there, but we mostly slept in tents. At one point we were, a bunch of us were exhausted, and there was a room, we had a room with two beds, And one of the other reporters, she's an AP reporter in Bogota, and she's, you know, she's a seasoned foreign correspondent, unlike me. You know, I mean, I'm used to mostly the comforts of the United States, you know. Mm-hmm. So she was like, let, you know, just sleep in the bed with me. We'll be fine. It's cool. And then there was like a couple of other people in the other bed, and we were woken up one night by a very large aftershock, and I was thrown to the floor, and I didn't have my contacts in. It was awful.
Oh my God.
It was horrific, actually. And, you know, and the things we saw during the day, it was so, you know, you just couldn't sleep inside because during the day I would see, you know, the effects of what happened to people who were inside during the earthquake. You know, you would see a building that six stories were mashed down, and you would see somebody's arm hanging out of the, you know, of the layers of the building. It was stunning, and it was really, really horrible. And I was not okay for a while after that. And then when I went back later that year in August, I had a very hard time sleeping through the nights, you know, and the AP by then had rented a huge house and had gotten structural engineers to look at it and make sure it was okay, but still it was very unsettling.
I think a lot of people don't realize that reporters who are on the scene are experiencing a similar trauma and are really traumatized also by these events, but you keep working through it. How did you deal with it? How did you come home and start to pull yourself together after that? Because that is a major, you know, life-changing event.
Yeah.
Those things.
Yeah, to the AP's credit, they brought the majority of us, there was a team of us kind of from Florida or in the Southeast who had worked on it, and they brought us in, and they actually had an employee assistance person and really encouraged us to seek further care also. They were very good about it. But for my situation, particularly, I literally got off the plane and I met my photographer colleague and my video colleague, and we went out and we just saw stacks of bodies. And then the second day, they had me go find the mass graves, and I did. And literally, I mean, I saw a person, I wrote a story about it on our way to the mass graves. We saw a body, and we thought, oh, and this is a horrible thing to think, but this was like sort of our mindset at that point. That body fell off the body truck because there were just these trucks, like these dump trucks filled with bodies. It was just horrible. And so we thought, oh, well, that body fell off the body truck. And we were coming back, and the photographer wanted a photo, and we stopped. And it turned out the woman was alive. And so we were like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? She was older, and she clearly had health problems beyond the earthquake, you know. We put her in the back of the SUV. We went to the nearest town. They didn't know her. They didn't want to take her. We tried to go to some other hospital. We couldn't find that. It was in Cité Soleil, the slum. I mean, it was crazy. And all this time, my editors are like, you know, asking me, well, can you get the story on the mass grave soon? Mm-hmm. And so we ended up just going to this hospital that we had been to the day before that was run by some missionaries. And we dropped her off. And, you know, hopefully she got, I mean, we didn't know what else to do. It was just at every turn, it was like there was somebody literally dying at my feet on the street. I mean, it was crazy. And it was really hard. It was hard to come back. And at one point, I just had to ask to come home. I was supposed to stay another couple of weeks. And I was down by the cathedral. And I realized that I was standing in just like 6 inches of powdered dust. And it just hit me like, I'm breathing this stuff. And I just freaked out. And I called my boss, and I was like, I have to come home now. I can't take it. I just hit the wall. It was crazy. It was really.
Well, I'm glad you took care of yourself that way, because, you know, some people would be uncomfortable speaking up like that. Mm-hmm. But I think this kind of explains a little bit why you might want to become a romance writer as your moonlighting job, because you don't want to go through that again in your fiction writing, right?
Right. Well, that's true. I think about this a lot. And, you know, I think, you know, I read pretty widely across the romance genre, and there definitely is a trend for real dark romance with very dark characters and very and really dark themes. And while I think that some of those stories are really well written, I realize that those are not the stories that I want to write. I really do want to write, and I hope that I achieved it, but I really do want to write about characters who want better for the world and who try to better the world, and who, and it is a bit of a fairy tale, because that is what I want to write at this point. I may change eventually, but when writing fiction, I want there to be sort of an elevated level of love and affection and adoration for each other. I don't want a lot of angst and anger in my romance novel.
And, you know, studies have shown that when people are reading fiction, they're really living out the roles of the characters and they really feel the experiences that they're going through. So, in fact, romance writers who are giving good experiences to readers and really kind of stimulating all those good hormones really are contributing to that.
I hope so. That would be that's the goal, at least. I really do believe that, you know, I believe that people want to read, to experience vicariously the feelings of love and of adoration and compassion. And those are things that I personally want to write about in my characters.
Now, technically, Lori Sue always says that she had to literally retrain her brain to write fiction after writing so many years of straight articles and books and things that were nonfiction. Based on your insights, what do you notice is the difference between the two?
Well, that's a really good point, because I really have had to, and I continue, and I think I will struggle till the end with this, but really putting the emotion in the fiction. Because I don't, you know, there's not a lot of room sometimes for emotion in news. And so that has been a challenge for me to get the emotion in and to amp the emotion up adequately.
Well, they call it the feels, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I struggle with that too. I know the readers like the feels, and I've been on dialogue. Do you find yourself using a lot of dialogue?
Now I am. I'm writing a novella right now that I'm trying to have pretty dialogue heavy. So, I'm experimenting with that. It's all really an experiment for me. I mean, this is a real departure from what I've done in the past. You know, I mean, when I was in my 20s, I thought that I wanted to write a romance novel, but I didn't have any formed ideas on what I would write about, and I didn't think it through. So I just kind of shelved it and put it away. And then I think it was probably 2012 that I really started to think about it again. And I wrote a chapter and then I put it away. And then in July of 2014, I took the chapter out and rewrote it. And that became what is now Hot Shade.
Wow.
Fascinating. And did you find that you had to develop a discipline for fictional writing versus journalistic writing?
Sort of. I do come home every night and write about 1,000 words a day. I mean, I'm pretty disciplined with it. I write every day. I usually write more on the weekends. I'm a pretty fast writer. Once I got the experience of that first book, I realized that I'm a much better pantser. I'm a much better plotter. I was a pantser for that first book. It didn't work out. And now I'm loving being a plotter. I'm really somebody who, you know, plots out every chapter before I start writing.
My husband's saying, what does that mean? Pantsers are people who just write by the seat of their pants, like
oh,
I do.
Okay.
Yep. What she's talking about is plotting out your scenes and your chapters. You know what's going to lead the character from, you know, the motivation, the action, and how they're going to get from one scene to another. You basically kind of know how you're going to start your book, the middle and the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, some people, do you fine tune it, like down to the scene? I know people who write every single scene out.
I have. I like to know where I'm, you know, exactly the scene that's ending it and exactly the black moment. Some of them I kind of play around with, but generally I find it works better. I've also realized that I'm probably because I'm a news writer, I should have started with category first, a category romance, a short 50,000 word length romance.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I enjoy reading that length a lot more than a single title romance. And I enjoy writing those because it really keeps the focus on the two main characters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I'm probably better served at this point in my career really trying to hone my category skills.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you talk about a pantser and a plotter. I guess I'm a spurter because things just come for me in spurts.
But I'm bomb. Well, that's really good that you have had a chance to kind of get a sense of, and you really do have to experiment to get a sense of what you want to write and, you know, how you want your characters to pan out and the word length.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really great. Did you have any challenges with, I know you said you like 50,000 words, but, you know, it's so interesting that the journalistic form is like the polar opposite sometimes of fiction, because in journalism, you have to be economical with your words. You got to tell the story up front. You don't mess around with it. You really got to get the facts out there. And in romance, you kind of have to stretch it out and tease and build anticipation. Was that a challenge?
Yeah, that continues to be a challenge. And I did hear a lot, and I do continue to hear, you know, you need to show and not tell. And I agree with that to some point, but I do think that, I may change my mind on this, but sometimes I think there's a little too much showing in certain books and not enough telling. I mean, sometimes I want the writer's voice to guide the story. I don't want to be shown every detail of every character's life. I don't want to read a 500-page book about a couple. I really don't. That's a terrible thing to say. I feel like a writer should tell me a story, should craft a story well, not just put up a lot of details on a page and let me wade through a lot of details. So I think that stories need to be told and edited well. And I'm not, you know, sometimes I'm not so sure. I'm not just talking about the romance genre here, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm not indicting anybody. But yeah, I mean, I have had the benefit of writing a lot of narrative nonfiction, and I did write a lot of long form narrative and have. In fact, the story that's on the AP Wire today is 2,200 words, which is a huge story for the AP Wire.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I've only written, you know, 500 word journalism stories. So I did have the benefit of that. I do wish though that I had gotten into romance writing and fiction writing before, because I think it would have helped my journalism long, long ago.
That's interesting. I had a friend who worked for AP in New York in the 90s, and he told me that one of the new things was they gave all the reporters cameras,
mm-hmm.
and asked them to go out and shoot the city and shoot some of their stories so they could start getting visual details
mm-hmm.
on the things they were covering.
Sure. I was obviously in the AP in the 90s, but I'm actually what they call a hybrid journalist.
Mm-hmm.
I shoot video also. And actually I shot a photo for today's story. I do a bunch of different things. So it's common that I have a video camera, and I was trained. I went to the National Press Photographers Association and took a boot camp on videography. So that has also helped. That kind of happened kind of around the same time that I was writing or thinking about fiction. So that has helped also. It's all kind of symbiotic.
Obviously that the reporting skills lend another part to the equation of writing a fiction story with authenticity. You have a lot of tools that you can call on for research. And how does being a reporter then help or guide your romance writing, and how often do you blend fiction with real life?
Well, that's funny, because when I was first writing, when I wrote the first draft of Hot Shade, I entered, you know, the first 30 pages or the first chapter into the Harlequin So You Think You Can Write contest. And some of the feedback I received was, well, this couldn't happen. You know, this would never happen. Obviously, a lot of what's in my book is sort of based on vaguely real events or some actual events in Florida, where really and truly truth is stranger than fiction. And I really had to learn that regardless of what kind of crazy stuff has happened in Florida, I need to really check and make sure it rings true in fiction, because it may, you know, it may be completely true, but it may not ring true in fiction. So that mm-hmm. was a big lesson for me, and it still continues to be a big lesson for me.
You know, the funny thing is that Lori Sue and I could share stories with you that are absolutely true that no one would believe. There's an old expression, I'm not going to use the vulgar word, but you can't make this blank up. You know,
right?
And we've seen so much of that happen.
Yep. Oh, sure. Sure. But in somehow it, some of that doesn't seem to translate to romance fiction sometimes. And I also, I tried to tackle a suspense. The first book was a romantic suspense, which I think is particularly hard. And sort of, I didn't do enough research, unfortunately, to know that it was hard. So if I had to do it over again, I would probably write a much easier 50,000 word category romance, mm-hmm. as opposed to a 90,000 word suspense novel.
Wow. You live and you learn.
You do.
That's a big lesson. Wow. Yeah. You know, they say that I'm sure you've taken a million workshops where they say, write what you know.
Yeah.
And you've heard that, right?
I have heard that, yes.
I was looking back at I have 7 little books published in the last year, and 6 of them, I think, are female reporter characters.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I thought, wow, I'm going to have to branch out. And one of them was a publicist in the romance industry.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering, you know, your first book is a young reporter.
Yes.
Right? She's the same age as you were when you started your career.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how much are you, you mentioned that some of your book is real, but how much are you writing what you know as a young 22-year-old reporter in that area?
I think there was a lot of writing what I know in that first book. And I think I needed to get that out, honestly. I think I needed to do that and write that character in order to move on so I could write characters that have nothing to do with anything that I know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if writing about reporters was the best choice in order to sell books. I don't know if people, you know, knowing what I know now and knowing after talking to some New York editors, one New York editor said, you know, you seem like a really good writer, but I don't really want to read about a reporter hero. He's just going to be laid off in 2 years. Is that like bad trombone after that? And we're talking about people at fairly large houses. I actually asked, you know, I have a second book. It's being shopped to publishers. It's about a newspaper publisher who inherits her family's dying newspaper, and she has to call her ex-boyfriend who runs a private equity investment firm for help. And he comes back, and since she broke his heart, he comes back for revenge. It's a very Harlequin Presents kind of trope. And my agent pitched it to, you know, publishers. And one publisher said, it sounds interesting, but I don't know if we want a newsroom story that's kind of white collar. Would you like to write about WWE?
I know. That's the newest thing, right?
I really wouldn't. I've covered Hulk Hogan, and I'm not interested in that. Thanks. But that's the thing, is I don't think, I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that people want to read about journalists. In fact, one of my readers wrote to me and said, I loved your book. I was unsure that I would even like the characters because I don't like reporters, but I ended up liking your characters. And that's sort of, I mean, you know, obviously everybody I know is a reporter. Everybody I know is a writer and was a reporter. And that sort of shocked me that people are just like, I'm not going to read it because I hate reporters. Like,
right.
So I'm sort of just chalking up my first book to, this is a fantasy fairy tale for female reporters.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great. Like, I remember when I was a young reporter, I watched every reporter movie. There wasn't one, even I Love Trouble. You know, that one with Nick Nolte and,
right.
I mean, every story about a reporter was so meaningful to me, even if the guy was a reporter.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it is true. Like, when you live in that world, because we eat, drink, breathe, sleep, mm-hmm. a story that we're working on or a package we're working on, you know, other people don't live like that.
Right.
You know, like other people don't stay all night at the office to put a story to bed.
Right.
So they don't always get it.
Yeah, I tried to capture some of that in the book, and I tried to capture, you know, what it's like to be a young reporter at a small paper in a small town when really all you want to be is in New York, you know, working for the New York Times or working for the AP and, you know, sort of the camaraderie of the newsroom. And my, you know, that's a large part of it. Like, there's one scene that Skylar, the reporter, she wakes up in the middle of the night because she wants to go buy the print copy of her newspaper because she's worried there's an error in the print copy.
just make sure the story's not screwed up.
Right, exactly. So I used to do it all the time. And, you know, I had to explain, like, you know, they ran a version of it online, but the longer version's in the print. And the story is about the hero's uncle. So she really wants it to be really good because she wants to impress the hero, you know. So, and she goes to the, you know, the convenience, the 7-Eleven, and, you know, she's in her pajamas and, you know. So I tried to capture some of that and, you know, some of the going out for drinks when you're a poor reporter. And there's this scene in the book. I think it's my favorite scene. She's out having drinks with her girlfriends from the newspaper and she's got her, you know, her glass of sangria in front of her. It's like, you know, the cheapest place in town. And the hero comes in and doesn't tell, you know, and it's not like he comes up to her. It's kind of this riff on that scene in Unfaithful. I don't know if you remember that scene in Unfaithful, the movie with Diane Lane and the really
sexy. Oh, my God, I do remember that scene. And actually, we pulled that scene out, and Vic is going to read it after this break.
Oh, okay, great.
And I just want to say that you're listening to Love and Romance Radio on the DTM Radio Network. Our guest tonight, Tamara Lush, author of the new book, Hot Shade. And Tamara, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
They can get my book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, iBooks, Smashwords, and they can also find out more information on my website, www.tamaralush.com. That's T-A-M-A-R-A, Lush, L-U-S-H, or tamaralush.com.
Wonderful. And as we say every week, also go to your local bookstore as part of your local economy and say, I want a copy of Hot Shade. And if they don't have it, have them order it for you and support your local bookstores. Thank you for my little homily there. So let's talk a little bit about this wonderful debut novel, Hot Shade. Let me share a little bit about it. Romance is the last thing on reporter Skylar Shaw's mind when she covers a plane crash on a Florida beach. Her best source could be a mysterious Italian man, but he's strictly off the record unless it involves indulging their electrifying attraction to one another. Little does Skylar know, but that crash is only the beginning. Luca Rossi is hiding a big secret. He's a journalist, too, and his anonymous expose on the mafia destroyed his world. Now, after 2 lonely years on the run, he'll do anything to possess this vulnerable American beauty. But Skylar is as relentless as the Florida glare, and the situation ignites when she reports on a gruesome murder in a swamp. Soon, erotic nights will bleed into dangerous days, and nowhere will be safe from the heat.
Oof. Wow.
So tell us a little more about these characters. Does this book touch on that eternal conflict of a reporter falling for her source, or do they work on the story together?
It's a little of the former. So she's covering a plane crash. There's a plane crash that runs down a guy. The plane had engine failure, so it runs down a guy on a beach who has a metal detector, which is really common in Florida. You know, there's people who are metal detecting out on the beach. Mm-hmm. And so she covers the story, and she doesn't really break into a gated enclave, but she slips into this gated enclave, which is where she sees this very handsome shirtless man with a sexy tattoo and a sexy accent and beautiful eyes. And so it's a female reporter's fantasy, and he's kind of flirtatious, but he's a little arrogant. He's kind of also like, what are you doing here? And why did you just break into the gated enclave? And so she leaves and she doesn't get his name, but then she files her story in her car, you know, which is very unglamorous. And then she goes back to look at the plane crash. And then he comes out and he says, why don't you come and have a drink with me inside? You look hot. I'll give you some water. So she does, thinking, well, maybe he'll give me, you know, the scoop about being the eyewitness to this plane crash. And so they end up sharing a very steamy kiss in the pool. So, and she feels bad about possibly, you know, kissing a source. So it kind of unfolds from there.
Woo! Oh, kissing a source. Always rough, right? Always the roughest thing.
Is that how you picked me up? You kissed me?
That's right. well, you know, we have a little snippet from Hot Shade. And I believe it's the one you were talking about before. And we thought we would just read it so our listeners could hear a little bit of banter between the characters. So
I'm going to be Luca and you're going to be Skylar,
I'll
right,
I'll be Skylar tonight, great, if that's okay.
Okay, so here's the setup. It's the 80s night at the Iguana, and Luca, who is normally in casual beach clothes because he's a writer who lives on the water, he's dressed up. Skylar's shocked to see him, mostly because they had a fight and because he looks so delicious.
Hmm.
Bellissima, Luca whispered. You look gorgeous tonight.
How did you know I was here? Skylar murmured.
You told the world on Twitter.
She smiled into his neck. So he had been reading her Twitter feed, Moth Meat Flame. Why are you all dressed up like that? She pulled back to look at him and traced his jaw with her finger. His almost beard was soft, and she wanted to bury her nose in his face, so she did.
You said you wanted to see me in something other than shorts and a t-shirt. You approve?
Her fingers stroked his neck under his collar. I do. A lot.
I've got to apologize. I don't do an Italian accent well. I think I sounded more like Bela Lugosi as Dracula.
A little bit. A little bit. But your regular voice is very sexy, so.
Meet me at the Casbah.
Well, okay, so replacing the Bela Lugosi voice with that hot, sexy, dripping with erotic energy Italian voice. Imagine that's how everyone just heard that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know what? You know what they say, that radio and reading is the theater of the mind, right? Because
yes,
in our minds, we see what we want to see, what we hear.
Well, I actually felt like we were sitting in that bar. We did that. So good work on the content, lady, because I think that fiction just came alive in this room.
Thank you. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
That was a great reading. I love that.
And, of course, my husband always is the sexiest reader in any voice. So how steamy does the book get? Like, what category would you put it in? Is it an erotic romance or?
You know, I that's a tough question. And it's interesting because one of the reviewers who liked it said they found it very interesting because Luca and Skylar, they don't have sex for a large portion of the book, but they do tons of other sexy things together.
Mm.
So I really didn't want to make it that, you know, they immediately hopped into bed. I didn't, you know, for various reasons, he didn't want to initially. I mean, he wanted to and she wanted to, mm-hmm, but for various reasons, they decided not to. And basically, she makes him wait until she feels comfortable with him. And so, but they do have many, many sexy times. And I've had people say, oh my God, it's an erotic romance. I've had a lot of journalists who don't read romance are like, oh God, it's erotica. And it's not erotica. I mean, it's, you know, by many romance standards, it's pretty tame. But I think that I tried to write, a real intimacy in the sexual scenes. And I think that's been the consistent feedback, is that the sex scenes and the intimate scenes are the best thing about the book. So
now, Skylar is very strong and very persistent, yet in this book we also see her as vulnerable and making sure that her story comes out right, worrying about her work and not being able to resist this hot Italian guy. What was it like for you to show her softer side?
That was difficult, and I worked a lot on that with my editor, Chris Kiesler. Chris is a pretty well-known romance editor. He's with Burroughs Publishing now. He used to be with Dorchester, and he really helped me kind of tease out the nuances of the characters, especially Skylar, making her character arc, you know, not one-dimensional.
Because, you know, in your real life as a reporter, you don't really like to show your vulnerable side too much, right?
Well, and actually, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, it was very interesting because I also I had entered a few contests. And I remember in an earlier version, Skylar was a lot more jaded, probably reflecting some of my own personal emotions about doing my job. Mm-hmm. And I remember I got contest feedback back, and they said, well, Skylar was, and initially I had the victims of the plane crash dying, and they said, You know, Skylar would be a lot more upset. Skylar would be crying as a reporter if she covered that. And I was thinking, when I read that contest feedback, I'm like, I just covered a mass murder, and I'm sorry I didn't shed a tear, which is horrible to say. But
right.
That's the reality of being a reporter. And that's also when I realized that I could not take my real life experiences and translate them to fiction, because they're just vastly different.
So does an objective reporter make a good romantic figure? I think that's the question.
Yes. Probably not.
Well, I think the interesting thing is, you know, you position the reporter as a very professional, you know, person who does her job and wants to be strong and wants to be quite capable and doesn't want to be vulnerable in front of other people. But then slowly you sort of break down her defenses and show this other side of her. And I think that also speaks to the idea that we, even if we write what we know, we're not always really writing our own personalities in there.
Right, exactly.
You know, people assume that romance writers, not that they're hanging from the chandeliers or anything like that, but that, you know, that part of the experience comes from something in their life. And, you know, for some people that's true, and for other people, it has nothing to do with their lives. Like, they really imagine it. Like, historical writers do the research into the historical period. And, you know, so it's interesting that you got to work on that character and reshape her into somebody who was not you.
Yeah, I really did try that. And Skylar, I also feel it was hard because this is also kind of branded as a new adult novel. And I think that Skylar is maybe a little more, I mean, she's, you know, it's a perfect new adult kind of story. She's just coming out of college. She's finding herself. She's learning her way in the world. But in some ways, she's too mature for new adult. And she's too together for new adult. I mean, horrible things have happened to her in her past, but she's also kind of picked herself up and moved on, and is very resilient. And that doesn't always reflect in new adult, that resilience, I don't think.
Is that because of what happened to Bella in Twilight?
I don't know. I noticed that a lot of new adult heroines seem to be very vulnerable and not very, it seems like a lot of new adult heroines just, how do I put this? They're not very strong. Some of them, they're very susceptible to, you know, sort of the whims of men, and they don't really have their own agency sometimes, I think. So I didn't want to write that character. I wanted to write a strong 22-year-old.
Right. Well, that is, you know, one of the complaints of the genre that I've heard strong, powerful women talk about. So what do you think, what are your thoughts on 50 Shades of Grey and this whole explosion that happened after 50 published? A lot of people talk about Anna Steele being one of those women who, not working within her own agency, but I actually thought she was a stronger character. She really kind of whipped that billionaire into shape.
Yeah, I mean, literally. I mean, I read 50 Shades of Grey. I think that the true aphrodisiac in that was that it was published during a recession and that it was really about money. I think that the story resonated with people because it was about wealth and power and money, not necessarily about sex.
Wow, that's the first time I have heard anybody say that. That's interesting.
I mean, I kind of feel like because it was, I mean, I think it became very popular because it hit bookshelves or e-readers right when e-readers were becoming popular. Because certainly the trope and the story Harlequin Presents has been doing for years and doing it very well and doing it very sexily, maybe not necessarily with bondage, but certainly there's plenty of bondage. But it was published what, in 2008, I think? It was published
2000. It came out from Random House in 2012, but it was published by the Writers Coffee House in Australia in 2011. And before that, it was fan fiction.
Right.
Published as Master of the Universe, and
right.
Before that it was an online story that was building every week.
Right. So it kind of rose to popularity, you know, right at the tail or 2011, right when the recession, I mean, was really in full swing, you know, or just coming out of the recession. So I think that that really spoke to people. I think that people were really turned on by the consumerism and the materialism of it, quite honestly.
That is fascinating.
And I'm just wondering if the art can also have to do with the fact that during that spiral in the economy, spiral down, that people felt the loss of control, and that
sure.
This book talked about control. He was controlling, and in her way, she actually was controlling him. And that having that power and control is something that people were actually aspiring to.
Well, actually, I have a thought about this because I think about these things a lot. And, you know, I think that a lot of these books, a lot of the new adult books and a lot of the books that have to do with BDSM, not the ones that are really heavily detailed into BDSM, the really well-researched ones, but these books that have to do with like the whole trend of the alpha male and the young woman, mm-hmm. I think, you know, especially for young readers, if you look, and I don't have children, so I need to qualify this, but I know that my friends who have children or who have older children, you know, this whole idea of helicopter parents and this whole idea that young people, college age people, people in their 20s have, you know, have had parents who have done everything for them. I don't think it's a coincidence that maybe they want to read fiction about heroes that are doing everything for them and that are making decisions for them and that are controlling their lives. For somebody maybe my age, your age, older, I'm not sure that those are the kind of heroes we want to read about. I'm not sure. I don't know. So.
Wow, I wish I knew you a while ago. I've been covering that 50 Shades story for 3.5 years, and I have talked to everybody about it, and you were the first person who mentioned, and Vic, what you said too, also great. So
yeah.
I might circle back with you on that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have some thoughts on it, and actually there's a blog, there's a writer who wrote about that, because I had pitched a story to the AP about when the movie came out and and about, you know, why the popularity, you know, because I don't think it's just about sex. Okay? I don't feel that it is.
I don't think it is just about sex either. And I got to tell you, you know, I've interviewed thousands, really, interacted with thousands of 50 fans over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that shocked me when I polled them numerous times about what they love about Christian Grey and about 50 Shades of Grey is that most of them said it was the love story.
Mm.
And I really thought it was I thought it was about the sex and the gazillionaire. But so many of the readers talked about how they loved the love story, which kind of brings us back to, you know, why romance books are so popular, because I never thought of that book in the beginning as a romance book.
Well, by technical definition, I guess the first one isn't, because it didn't end happily.
That's true, because E.L. James really is the queen of the cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, fortunately, all those books were out at the same time. I think that also really helped them along.
So wait, to have the romance genre applied to it, does it have to be boy meets girl, boy whips girl, girl whips boy?
No, you have to have a happy ending.
No, that's what I mean. They, you know, after they whip each other, they get together. And,
yeah, you have to have a happy ending. So in those books, you have to wait till the third book. However, you know, I think that also created the whole longing and the whole, you know, trilogy thing happening in the romance industry. And everybody started publishing. Sometimes they were publishing one book in four different segments or three different segments. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one of the reasons people who have not really read those books don't understand that there really is a transformational love story in there is because they end on book one.
Oh.
Right.
And it has a horrible ending.
Right.
Right.
So, woof. I could go on about that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. It's very fascinating.
Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah.
To see a book like that go boom, just all over the place.
I actually covered a story about 50 Shades of Grey when it was, I guess it was probably 2012. And it was because some of the libraries were banning it. So I did a story, and I actually was on a morning show, a network morning show about it and stuff. So.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I read it, actually.
I was working for a health site at the same at that time, and I wrote about five stories on it. One of them was a study that had traced the abuse in book one, and then there was a story on how the fans were going crazy about who was going to play Christian Grey, and I interviewed a bunch of fan experts, and I talked to psychiatrists about it, but... you know, let's get back to your work for a second, because we can really...
I was going to say one more thing about 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, have you ever looked... I mean, I'm assuming you've seen 9.5 Weeks.
Yes, yes.
And the parallels between them, but if you really look at them, and if you really look at the heroine in 9.5 Weeks, and I'm not talking about the book here, because I understand that's a very separate thing.
Yeah.
In at least the movie or the both of the movies, if you look at the trailers, they're very similar. But really, 9.5 Weeks, even though what it's almost 30 years old now, God, imagine that.
that for those of us who saw it in the theater,
9.5 Weeks. You know, the heroine, the female character in that, is actually a very, very strong character, much stronger than Anna.
But she, I mean, the Kim Basinger version of her, which was really fascinating with Mickey Rourke, of course.
God, he was beautiful, right? Mickey Rourke, he was beautiful.
Oh my God, he was so hot then, and he was so dominant, and it was so sexy.
Right.
But she really did, in that book, in that movie, she really did surrender to this experience with him. But there wasn't a love story that was... The love story was not the same. It wasn't really a romance story. It was really a domination story and a game. And he was sad when she left, but it was the whole idea of this powerful woman just surrendering to this erotic experience, right? For a
you know,
period
of I went time. Back and rewatched the movie recently, and I did see a love story there.
Oh, okay. I got to watch it again.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch again after all these years.
My husband's saying wrap it up on 50 Shades of Grey, but let me just say one more thing. I caught the movie Secretary the other night.
Oh, wonderful movie.
Oh, my God. When I saw that movie, that's James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and he's a dominant, and she's a very, you know, she's an emotionally challenged young woman who becomes really super, uber strong in the relationship with him, and it really is a kinky love story, and so well acted. Oh, my God. It was really fun to see.
Love that movie.
Let me get this gag out of my mouth and continue with the interview.
I'll untie you a little.
Given your 22 years as a reporter, clearly you've had people turn you down and close doors to an interview. How has that prepared you for possible rejections that come in the publishing industry?
Oh, I mean, I've been rejected a lot. I'm sure I'll continue to be rejected. I mean, I guess initially I sort of thought like, well, I thought they would want me. I'm an AP reporter, but I realized very quickly that that doesn't mean anything. So, it doesn't faze me a whole lot, I guess. I don't know. I just sort of move ahead. I mean, I will consider self-publishing. I'm planning on self-publishing a novella actually at the beginning of 2016. I think that the thing that frustrates me most is that the publishing industry is really slow.
I was going to ask you about that.
And I think, well, you know, the AP can, you know, write a story about slaves on ships and on fishing ships in Thailand and get them freed within 18 months. Like, why can't they read my manuscript about, you know, people having sex in 18 months? But that's my cynical reporter side. Like, I understand the process, and I understand, and I know that I have to be respectful of it. Sometimes that's a little hard for me. Like, maybe I'm a little arrogant, or maybe I'm a little like skeptical of why it's taking so long. So
it's a different process than journalism. Totally different.
To rein it in. But I also think it is a different process, but I also think self-publishing is also a very viable option and a very great option, and I think a very rewarding option. And so I may dip my toe in that water, although I do really love Burroughs, and I have a second book with them in the editing process, and then I'll have a third book. So, and they're all set on the same island as Hot Shade. So,
what was surprising and delighting to you about your relationship with Burroughs?
Oh, Chris Kiesler is a wonderful editor. I mean, he's just a wonderful, thoughtful editor who really can craft a great story and help me craft a great story. I mean, that's been amazing.
He has a great reputation, and he's a very nice guy.
He's a really nice guy.
Very nice. Mm-hmm. So is there an author who inspires you? Like, who's your role model? Who would you like to be when you grow up?
Oh, gosh. In terms of romance, I love Lisa Kleypas. She writes historical, and I'll probably never write historical, but she is I love her work. I also really love, for contemporary romance, I love Molly O'Keefe. I think she's a wonderful writer. I think her stories are wonderful. Somebody who's written two books, Rebecca Brooks. I think she's a great writer and writes some really thoughtful stories.
Mm-hmm.
So all three of those women. Yeah. And I have to say, like, I read a fair amount of Harlequin. I like Harlequin Presents. I like Harlequin Desire. I like both of those lines. I think that they're underappreciated and underrated. I think that some of their writing is really good and tight, and mm-hmm. they're really quick emotional reads. It's really hard to do what they do.
They have good authors, and they have evolved so much over the years. It's amazing. But people think, they hear the name mm-hmm. and they think of a certain thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think Harlequin does a great job.
So let me ask you, were you born with this amazing romance writer name? I mean, you have such a fabulous name for writing.
Yes, I was. That is my maiden name. That's not my married name. That is my actual real name.
That is amazing. What a blessing.
What is Lush? What is that nationality or heritage does that come from?
My father was born in Canada, and his parents were born in England.
Okay. All right.
Beautiful. So, yeah. English.
And are there any other books, new books, that we can have look forward to coming from you next year?
Yes. So I have one with Burroughs that's coming out. It's set on Palmyra Island. It is Hot Shade is a standalone. The second one is a standalone. It will be called Into the Heat. And it's a category length, and the heroine in it, she knows Skylar. Skylar's only mentioned very briefly. She is falling in love. She's a bed and breakfast owner, and she sees her first love on the beach, and she rekindles her relationship with him. But it's complicated because he is an Afghanistan war veteran, and he's got some issues. So it's probably a much more conventional story. There's a little bit of intrigue in it. And then there will be a third story set on Palmyra. And those three will be with Burroughs. And then, like I said, I'm writing a novella. And my novella is actually going to be part of an erotic anthology that is all Florida writers and all Florida set stories, which is going to be really exciting.
Ooh.
I'm really excited I'd love to promote that with you guys next year because it's going to be 13 writers from Florida, and we have historical, paranormal, shifters.
Oh, right.
And hot Florida sex.
Hot Florida sex. My story is about a bookstore owner who writes erotica, and she goes to a literary event called Story Brothel, and a handsome man pays her to read him a story.
Wow.
So this is a 25,000 word. I'm going to self-publish it myself, and then it'll be in the anthology. But it's a 25,000 word standalone, and I'm hoping for fun things with it.
What do you think about the paranormal genre in romance?
I don't read it a lot. I'm a pretty literal person. I don't read it a lot, but I will say that I like some. I really like Sylvain Renard's The Raven series.
I just interviewed him.
Oh my goodness, you did.
Well, we think he's a him.
What was it over? Was it over the phone or was it?
No, we have a special way of doing it. It has to be done by email, and it has to go through his publicist. But after I did the interview, I interviewed him a few months ago, and then I updated it because he's got a new book coming out in February. So I sent him a few new questions. And then he communicated on Twitter by posting it and sharing it with E.L. James, and she shared it, and so it was really fun. Yeah,
I love his writing. I think that
I do too.
I think that he has like that real fairy tale quality about his writing, and I loved The Raven. I'm liking that series a lot. So I liked Gabrielle's. I like the Gabrielle trilogy too.
I did too. He's a It's just the yummy, mm-hmm. you know, you kind of love these yummy guys who, the whole first book is just foreplay.
Totally.
It's just a big, drawn out.
Totally.
Exciting. Her first book, Hot Shade, the author, Tamara Lush, AP reporter, journalist, and romance writer. Tamara, please tell our listeners how they can find out about you, find out about Hot Shade and all the new books that you have coming, and everything else there is to know about Tamara Lush.
Thank you. They can find out about me on my website, TamaraLush.com, TamaraLush.com, or they can find me on Facebook, Tamara Lush Writes, or just Tamara Lush. They can friend me. I'll friend you back. And my books are available on Amazon, iBooks, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, you can request them at your local bookstore as well.
Wherever amazing hot romance books are sold.
Oh, this is so great. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. This is a great interview.
This is a blast. Thank you, Tamara.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yay.
Okay. So, Lori Sue, another wonderful love and romance show in the book.
Yes, yes, yes. Very
and who do
exciting.
We have? Who's our guest next week, darling?
Our guest next week is Laura Day. Our good friend Laura Day is going to talk about using your intuition to fall in love.
Wonderful. Until next week, I'm Victor the Voice Furman.
And I'm Lori Sue Brockway, the Romance Reverend.
And this is Love and
Romance Radio.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.